Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My next guest, Pico Iyer, has served as the Dalai Lama's biographer, traveling with him across Japan 10 times and leading public conversations with him everywhere from Jaipur to New York City. Iyer may be the greatest cross-cultural observer of our modern age. He's a longtime essayist for Time Magazine and the New York Times, and once heralded by Outside Magazine as arguably our greatest living travel writer. Wow, something most of us would love to aspire to. His work has deepened enormously over the decades to encompass introspection, philosophy, and spiritual inquiry. He joins me now to discuss his new book, The Half-Known Life, In Search of Paradise. Pico, it's a pleasure to have you. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much, Lynn. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, we're all just in search of paradise, aren't we?
We are. And I actually think it's not so impossible to find. I mean, this book came out of the pandemic, and it's not included in the book, but 20 hours after lockdown was announced here in California, my poor mother, who was 88 years old, was rushed into hospital in an ambulance. She was losing blood at a very frightening rate. And I flew back from my little apartment in Japan to be with her. And I was with her for 6.5 months as we were wavering between life and death. And I think I was thinking, like everybody across the planet in that pandemic, how can I find calm and hope and clarity in the middle of this difficult situation? And life is so often difficult, but I don't think that precludes finding inspiration and light.
There is something about finding inspiration or a muse to help you find your way to how to even know what it is that makes us happy and therefore something that could help us find paradise, right? And I think that's why, you know, your travels around the world and studying other cultures and being in the company of the Dalai Lama have really, I mean, it really helps you center in on what's important, right?
You're right. Exactly so. I mean, I think the pandemic, one good thing that came out of it is all of us asked, what's really important? What do we care about most? And how can we stay close to it? And just as you perfectly say, Lynn, I have been lucky to spend all the time with the Dalai Lama. And he's the perfect example of what I'm describing, because of all the people I know, I would say he's had the most difficult life. He hasn't got to see his homeland for 63 years. The government of the largest nation on earth calls him a devil. He's lost his brother, his mother, everybody around him. And what is the Dalai Lama famous for? His constant smile and his infectious laugh and his robust confidence. And it's a reminder that even if circumstances are difficult, what really determines our lives is what we do with those circumstances. And when I travel with the Dalai Lama, every person he meets, from a five-year-old boy to somebody in a shopping mall, he sees as a point of possibility, a new friend, somebody he can learn from. So that's probably available to all of us if we just wake up to that possibility.
Well, and it's wonderful to recognize those people in our lives, like the Dalai Lama, or those moments of inspiration. But it's funny how we can get such instruction in how to live our own lives from both inspiration, but also the hard times. I feel like, and I think you maybe were starting to say, during the pandemic and any tragedy that befalls us or difficulty, it really makes you consider what's important in life. And do you feel like in a sense, in our modern culture, we have just gotten away from what's important in life?
I do exactly that. I mean, I think in 2019, I'm speaking for myself, but I bet it applies to other people. We were kind of joyriding in a Porsche around blind curves at a crazy pace, not really even wondering, knowing if we were going in the right direction. And suddenly life put up this roadblock and it made us stop and think, how do we really want to live? And I've been very moved and impressed that so many people have remade their lives in the wake of the pandemic. And I remember throughout the pandemic, I was remembering how one time I was at my family home here in the hills of California, and I walked upstairs. There was a 70-foot wall of flames. That was the worst fire in Californian history at the time. I was in the middle of it. It wiped out our house, and it wiped out everything that we owned in the world. And so, of course, it was a big shock. But 6 months later, I realized that actually it was opening doors and giving me the chance to remake my life and actually to live much closer to the life I'd always had. So it was a difficult situation at the time, but it helped me start again and live closer to the life I'd wanted. And I found that with a lot with the pandemic. And as you said, the other thing about the pandemic is it's moments of crisis that often move us to bring out the deepest in ourselves and the kindest. And all the world was brought together and we were in that same boat. And I think I remember reading how during the Blitz in World War II, the rate of suicide in Britain went way down. And that in moments of difficulty, we rise to potentials we didn't even know we had.
And it gives us a different sort of purpose or something. If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Pico Iyer. He's a biographer of the Dalai Lama, and he's discussing his new book, The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. Now, I have never been to the far reaches of the globe like you have, but I do remember this time when I was in my 20s and I had done this hike up the highest peak in Latin America. It was in Guatemala. And on the way back down, there was this deluge and it started to flood everywhere around us. And we saw these people motioning to us from a hut and they said, come in, get shelter. So we went in and it was, you know, had a mud floor, dirt floor. It was very humble. It was just this little hut. They had a fire. They had a little aguardiente cooking on the stovetop. And there was so much laughter and joy. And it really struck me as this thing like that it doesn't matter how little you have or how much you have, happiness can come in the most surprising of ways. And that really struck home for me. And I'm wondering in all of your travels, like to North Korea, for example, you know, what do you find chatting with people there? We would think they would be so oppressed. They would be very sad, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me otherwise.
It's certainly been my experience, just as you say, Lynn, that often the people with the least have the most to give. And that here I am in California, a very affluent place, and a lot of my friends are not so optimistic. And then I will go to Guatemala or Haiti or Cambodia and find this great strength and optimism and people smiling in difficult circumstances. North Korea, I went to just because I wanted to see a human face. Mm-hmm. Because we hear the word North Korea and we usually just see one face, not 25 million others. And that's just what the one face, if he's an oppressive leader, wants. And so even the tiny moments I could get there when in the safety of the minivan, a North Korean would lean forwards and ask two people from Apple Computers, what's Tim Cook's management style? Is it different from Steve Jobs's? And just the fact that North Koreans were thinking about Apple Computers and knew that much, suddenly it's not just a dark abstraction or a name on the map. It's a human face and a human voice. And I think what's scary about North Korea is that they're not allowed much knowledge of us. And so it's that much easier to launch a missile against just a name. But I come back here and I think we know so little about North Korea. And as you said, we're lucky enough, we have the freedom to travel. We have the freedom to read and get access to anything we want. So we need to know more about the rest of the world. And that's why I call this book The Half-Known Life, because I sometimes feel in this age of information, we actually know less than ever before, and maybe least of all about the countries we hear most about, like Iran or North Korea or Cuba. So I try to go to those places to remind them that an American isn't just one person in the White House, and to remind myself that these places are much more complex than our ideas of it, and that actually sitting here in California, I'll assume I know a lot about the rest of the world. And as soon as I arrive, get off the plane in Iran, oh, I didn't know a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, we are very lucky when we can travel, and it is the result of, you know, greater affluence to be able to travel. But there are ways also of traveling within your own town. It's having conversations with the cashier at the grocery store who's from the Philippines or whatever it may be. How do you encourage people to sort of travel in their own towns?
Exactly. I mean, it's a wonder of my lifetime that the whole globe has come to our doorsteps, especially in big cities. But as you say, even in small towns, most people don't have the time or the resources to go to Iran or North Korea, as I do. But as you say, just talk to the person in your dry cleaners, just get into a cab. I was in New York City 2 days ago, every time I got into a cab, the driver was from Senegal, Haiti, Ethiopia, Vietnam. And if I just began asking questions, and I found out these amazing stories. Many of them are doctors and lawyers in their home country. They've risked a huge amount to come to this country. And they're bringing the wisdom and the stories of their countries right into our midst. And it's a treasure, just down the street, really. And I don't want to forget about it or sleepwalk past it.
It's interesting as you say that, Pico. It reminds me of a dear friend of mine who has this sort of code of behavior, or whatever it is that he does. He always says, and he teaches this to young people, just ask someone three questions about themselves. And it doesn't really matter what it is, but get them talking. And this is how we connect to other humans. And it's strange how often you meet people who will never ask you a single question about yourself. So it is almost like an art. What are those questions when you're in a taxi cab in New York City that you ask?
What surprised you most about America? How much do you miss your home? And where do you want to raise your kids? And always surprising answers. It's somebody who's risked his life and given up everything to come from Pakistan to New York City, is really grateful to be here, but wants to send his kids back to Pakistan, or wants to move back to Pakistan once he can retire. And the other dimension to this, just as you say, there are all these human treasures around us when we walk down the street, and all these natural treasures. So during the pandemic, I couldn't travel as much as I usually would, and the health club was closed. So I started taking walks with my wife, just on the road behind my mother's house. It was usually early in the morning, and the sun was coming up on the ridge, mountains were flooded with golden light, Pacific Ocean was in the distance. And again, I thought, my goodness, this is as beautiful as anything I would travel around the world to see in Cape Town or Rio de Janeiro. Here it is in my backyard. And my parents have been in that property for 50 years, and I'd never walked to the end of the road 20 minutes away until lockdown forced it. And it was really a reminder. I'm sure many people listening to this conversation had the same experience. If you're in Utah or around Park City, you probably know how beautiful it is. But I bet you discovered things in the pandemic through necessity that you never had realize were there.
Oh, absolutely. And meeting neighbors that you had never met in the 20 years that you lived in the neighborhood, because all you do is pull into your garage and go inside. So that is such a great observation. I wanted to ask you, Pico, about, there seems to be a movement more recently, people doing spiritual tours or tourism, but it is also connected to some sort of psychedelic, ayahuasca, peyote, psilocybin. And I don't mean to disparage that kind of spiritual quest. But I'm just wondering, you know, as we do those sorts of things, is that... You know, should we be doing that? Should we be finding our more spiritual side through, you know, the use of drugs?
Well, I did actually have one chapter on psychedelics in this book, which I took out. My sense of it, without having experienced very much, is psychedelics, like falling in love, give us an intimation of something, but it doesn't always last, and it's hard to make real and concrete. And I think the Dalai Lama would say, it gives you a sense of altered states, but altered traits is a really important thing. And that tends to involve day in, day out, hard work. The way we go into our health clubs to work on our muscles, I think the wisest people I know go and work on their inner muscles. The emotional health club or the mental health club, go there every day and put in their 30 minutes through meditation or whatever it might be. And I think that's what affects lasting change. So it's like ayahuasca would give you a glimpse of this is the way the world could be. But once you're back at home in Utah or California, how are you going to sustain and deepen that glimpse? And then I'm not sure it works to keep on turning to the psychedelics day after day. You probably need some practice that's really going to transform you within. One knows, I know as a traveler, a trip is a wonderful form of transport. Every kind of trip is a great form of transport. But most of your time is spent back in your regular life. How are you going to change that? And that's the question I guess I was asking in this book. And that's why I talk about Thomas Merton, the great Cistercian monk who found his great moment of illumination in front of some Buddhas in Sri Lanka, or the Dalai Lama, because these are people who are radiating something that you feel, whatever they're taking, I want to take too, because they've worked a substantial transformation in their lives. And I don't think there are any shortcuts to that.
In the case of the Dalai Lama, you just see a picture of him, let alone be in his physical presence, as you have been so many times, and you just want to smile. Yes. Did he come into the world as a person like that? Or, you know, how did he transform, or how did he engender that sort of, or foster that sort of trait for himself?
Yeah, it's a really beautiful question, and I'm not sure I can answer it. Of course, they found him as Dalai Lama when he was two, which suggests that there were some qualities he had from the beginning, but I think it's a lot of training. And when I travel with him, we go shopping in a shopping mall in Yokohama. We'll stop and have tea together at a convenience store. He'll greet every truck driver who comes in, just the way you're describing. So it's wonderful to see it in action. But I'm always reminded every morning, I go into his room at 8:30, and I've had a nice long sleep, and I've had a great buffet breakfast, and I go in. And then I realize he's woken up at 3:30 every day of his life and put in 4.5 hours of meditation. And I think that's how he's so alert and brings that kind of radiant energy to every moment of his day. And he has 8-hour working days, and I'm 22 years younger than he is. And I'm exhausted just watching him go through his day, but he never takes a break in the course of that day. And I think it's because he's laying the foundations with those 4 hours of meditation. And I always feel, as you said, when none of us is the Dalai Lama, and that's not our job. But if the busiest man I know can spend 4 hours clearing his head every morning, maybe I can spend 20 minutes. And it could be formal meditation, but just sitting quietly in a room without your devices. I think if you spend 20 minutes doing that, the rest of your day will be transformed. And I guess the half-known life is about how to bring that spirit of transformation into the most difficult places, whether it's the Himalayas or Varanasi or Jerusalem.
Yes. So you've spent a lot of time in the presence of Buddhas and monks and places like Sri Lanka and the Himalayas. And I'm just wondering what surprises you most about them. And it could, you know, it could be anything. It could be something negative. I don't know.
I think the biggest surprise is how open-minded they are, that the more deeply grounded you are in your tradition, the more you're open to every other tradition. So the Dalai Lama, as you know, actually delivers lectures on the Gospels to groups of Christians, and tears come to his eyes when he talks about the parable of the mustard seed. And he's called himself a defender of Islam. He seeks out the Council of Rabbis. How can he sustain a culture without a homeland? And I spend a lot of time with a group of Catholic monks here in California, and I'm not a Catholic myself, but exactly the same thing. They're practicing yoga. They're talking to their Zen brothers to get good tips. And we all sense that the world now is more connected than it's ever been, but it's also more divided. And I turn to people like the monks and nuns because they've reached a state where they're not caring about the divisions. They know what they believe, and that means that they want to learn from everybody else and deepen and challenge their beliefs. You know, a monk lives with doubt as much as faith. And I call this the half-known life because I feel that one of the problems in the world right now is so many of us saying, I know more than you. I know better than you. My way is the true way. And you look at the Dalai Lama or Thomas Merton or my Catholic monk friends, they never feel that their way is the only way, or they know better than everybody else. And that's one of the things we have to learn from them. I think humility. The wisest people I know are also the most humble. I once saw Pope Francis give a talk actually to TED, and he just said at the end, pray for me. And I felt it was so from the depths. He was not saying he's on top of everything. Exactly the opposite. He's in the mercy of larger things. He doesn't know everything. And that's what draws us towards Pope Francis or the Dalai Lama or Archbishop Tutu or so many others.
Yes. And does it make you go through your life when you're coming up against something controversial or someone who is oppositional to just say, I don't know. I don't know. That could be
Yes. I know it tends to divide us, and I don't know it tries to bring us together. And I think in the pandemic, we were all brought together because none of us had a clue. Nobody knew what was going to happen the next day or that night, how long the pandemic would last, whether it would ever end. And we were joined in this great, I don't know. And my hope was that would help us out of, I know how to make this country better. I know what to do to mm-hmm. make the world a different place, which, you know, our ideas and our certainties get in the way of life, which I think is much wiser than we are. So I do like that I don't know space because that's where growth happens. And you know, I remember when I was a kid, I knew everything. Like, yeah, I was a know-it-all when I was in my 20s. And the older I've got, the less I see how much I know. And I'm really grateful for that, that life is always going to surprise me in any number of ways. And yeah, and that life has much richer plans for it than I have plans for life.
Yes. Pico, what is your paradise?
Right here, right now. I'm getting the chance, thanks to this new technology, to talk to you and have a really fun and rich conversation. And just, I want to open my eyes to the opportunity that every moment brings, because I think it's a matter of choice. Every day in the pandemic or every day after my house burnt down, when I woke up, I could either think, I'm so grateful for the things I still have. I'm healthy, my mother's healthy, my wife's alive. So much to cherish. I can take that walk on the back road. Or I could be frustrated with what I don't have. But I feel that many of us have that choice. And I found my days would be much happier if I rejoiced in all the possibilities than if I complained about all the frustrations, because there'll always be plenty of opportunities and frustrations. But where I direct my gaze will probably determine the rest of my day or my life, and also determine how people feel when they see me. Because if I'm talking about my frustrations, people will probably head for the door as quickly as possible. And if I'm talking about the fact it's a beautiful day and we're healthy and it's a winter sunshine all around, they want to hear more and they'll want to share more.
So true. I recently spoke with the co-director of this, the longest running study of human development and happiness from Harvard. It's in its 84th year. And, you know, it was pretty basic. I mean, they've studied almost 1,000 people over the course of their lives about what makes them happy. And it was so simple in the end. It was connection. It was relationships. I just wonder, as you go around, and obviously you're witnessing the Dalai Lama, he's forming relationships with everyone he comes in contact with. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what your takeaway is and what your suggestions are for us to form meaningful relationships, even if they're brief.
Yes. Well, maybe I'll answer that in relation to our attitude. One of the things I've learned from the Dalai Lama is that unhappiness is not the same as suffering. As a Buddhist, he feels that life is always going to bring suffering. Most of us will get sick. If we're lucky, we'll get old. We'll all die. But that doesn't mean we have to be unhappy. Unhappiness is just the position we choose or cannot choose to bring to it. And where I live in Japan, they often, it's a variation on that. They say life is about joyful participation in a world of sorrows. That autumn's always going to come, as is winter. We're all going to lose loved ones or lose ourselves. But none of that is a recipe for sorrow. And in fact, that's the reason we have to be joyful. In my book, I write, the fact that nothing lasts is the reason that everything matters, which came home to us in the pandemic. And when it comes to relationships, again, during the pandemic, suddenly I thought, here I am with my 88-year-old mother. Let me make the most of this. I don't know if she'll be here tomorrow. Let me cherish this moment and talk to her and ask her as much as possible, precisely because nothing ever lasts forever. And that should bring us to a point of alertness and maybe gratitude for what we do have.
The book is The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. My guest is Pico Iyer. And I just want to say, I think the greatest compliment to you is that your dozen books have been translated into 23 languages. That must feel like such a compliment to the work that you do.
Thank you. I'm so glad we live in a global world and we can talk across our borders more easily than ever before. So yes, thank you.
All right. Wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much, Pico.
Thank you, Lynn. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your wonderful, smiling, encouraging presence. It makes a big difference.
Oh, thank you. All right. Have a wonderful book tour and best of luck.
Thank you.
little bit of words of wisdom we can all learn from Pico Iyer there, that interview. Next up is Vincent Tolman. Stay tuned after a word from our underwriters.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
At one time or another, we've all wondered, is there life after death? Do you see light and what does it look like? Our next guest knows the answer to this question intimately. In his new book, The Light After Death, author Vincent Tolman shares his true life experience on the other side of death. Vincent, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Yeah, awesome to be here. Thank you so much, David and Lynn, for having me. I appreciate it.
What a story. We've all been curious about this. We've all wondered what happens. And just share with our audience a little bit about what happened to you and your story.
Well, this actually happened there in Utah when it happened, actually. I see that you guys are in Utah there. I took a supplement with a buddy of mine. We were headed up to an auto expo and then to go do some workouts. So we took this new supplement, and come to find out the version that we got from an international company was quite toxic. It was not a good supplement. So it had a bad effect on both of us. My buddy and I went to a restaurant to go get a bite to eat. Hopefully that would help us feel better. He made it barely in the restaurant, collapsed on the booth and started to vomit. They hauled him away in an ambulance. Meanwhile, I went in the bathroom, locked the door, and nobody saw us coming together. So nobody knew that I was in there. So about 45 minutes to an hour after he was already hauled away and taken care of, and he turned out to be fine, they did find me dead in the bathroom and pronounced me dead, but with the medics that arrived shortly thereafter and put me in a body bag and did the normal. They went to turn me into the Utah County Medical Examiner's Office and for possibly an autopsy. And on that way, a medic felt a prompting, you know, call it what you want, but he felt this intuition or this prompting tell him that this one was not dead. And he went ahead and broke protocol, which he could have been fired for. And first week on the job, even, he opened that body bag and started to try to resuscitate the body and was able to actually get the heart to come back. And, you know, after about the third round of shocks, he got a clean heartbeat coming and steady. So they were able to get the heart started again about 2 hours, close to an hour and a half, 2 hours after that, the actual death. So it was quite an experience. I was, you know, the body was essentially alive at that point, but the brain wasn't. The brain had been, you know, deprived of oxygen long enough that it was essentially brain dead. And so for 3 days, while that body was in a coma, I was off playing on the real side of existence, not on this virtual reality where we exist now. So yeah, it was amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Oh, my heart just like stopped and started during that story. Holy wow. That's so walk me through, Vincent, when you were, so as you started coming out of this experience, you know, the coma and your brain and consciousness became more aware of what had happened. What started to transcend inside you and make you realize the experience you had been through?
You know, it was really weird right at the first, when I first woke up, I would just felt so claustrophobic and I was so consumed by this claustrophobia that I didn't even remember anything that had happened to me until the day after, when my sister asked me if I had a near-death experience because I was pronounced dead and I was in a coma and all of that. And so until she had asked me that question, I actually didn't remember the experience. And when she asked me, I went to just form the words, no, of course not, you know? And as the words started to form, just what flowed out of me was this experience. And it was literally like a download, like the entire experience just showed up. And at first, I'm a very cynical person, a little bit, you know, I don't just trust everything in this world. And so even myself, I thought, well, maybe, you know, I started to believe what a neurologist told me, that this was my imagination, just trying to make things up to fill in the gaps. But, you know, I met this guide in this experience, somebody I'd never seen before, somebody I didn't know. And, you know, 7 months later, I was in this little town in Wyoming called Afton, and I was watching this presentation at a high school. And I watched this slide of this man come up on the screen. And it was my guide. It was absolutely my guide. There was no question. And he didn't have the same last name as me. But he did have the same last name as my grandmother's maiden name. And so I thought, well, maybe there's something there. But I went, and the slide, you know, my guide's name was Drake, and the slide that of his picture said Charles. That was another thing that didn't make sense to me. So I went to my grandmother and I said, "Hey, you know, have you ever heard of a guy named Charles Kazer?" And she goes, "Oh, you mean great grandpa Drake? Oh yeah, I can tell you lots of stories about him." And that was my first confirmation that, that for sure, unequivocally, this was not something I could have just made up in my imagination. I was pulling things out that were impossible to know, things that, that I couldn't know, the consciousness couldn't know. And this was one of them. This, it turned out that he was my great, great, great grandfather on my grandmother's side. So it was just absolutely amazing to experience this and know now that my experience was real. And the things I learned, even more importantly, are real things that I could help begin a new life for myself and live in a new way, and help others to do that too, if they want to. So that's what I've essentially set out to do for the time since. And for many years, for over 10 years, I shared my experience with church groups and, you know, small groups, large groups, all sorts of groups, mostly faith-based. And every single time I would share it, I would get asked, you know, when are you going to write a book? You got to get it in a book. So I finally did. It took me quite a while, and I wanted to do it justice. It's very hard to put into words what this experience was, because the experience is so far outside of words. So to kind of confine it into words was really hard. And for years I struggled with it. I felt like I was failing, and finally I got the help of this amazing guy from Weber County up there named Lynn Taylor. And I'll tell you what, amazing man, amazing writer. He really changed things for me. He was able to put into words things I could never do. So together we wrote this book, and he helped kind of hold my hand through it and help me do it justice, do it the right way it should be, so that people understand it from the best possible perspective.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with author Vincent Tolman. His book is called The Life After Death, My Journey to Heaven and Back. It's actually the 20th anniversary of when this event took place, that Vincent, you were found dead on a bathroom floor here in Utah.
Yep.
And after half an hour, the paramedic broke protocol, thought, and that there's a question in there for me too. Your body is in a body bag. Had there been no efforts to resuscitate you already?
No, they had. When they first came upon the body was cold to the touch, and had been dead for a while, for a good amount of time already. But they did. They attempted chest compressions. They attempted trying to pump some air into the lungs with, you know, manual pump, but without resolve, without any result. So they did, you know, pronounce me dead shortly after arriving on scene.
Mm. You are obviously clearly aware. You have written a book. A lot of people would say, what happens to the brain? You know, there must be a significant amount of brain damage if you are dead for that long. And as you describe, even the ensuing 3 days, you were considered brain dead. I mean, explain how this all happened.
So, you know, the body, being that it was starved of oxygen for so long, the brain didn't come right back. It was very slow in responding to the resuscitation. And, you know, 3 days on life support, I was on full life support for 3 days. And during that time, I was brain dead, essentially in a coma. And I don't want to shorten the miracle of it, because it was an absolute miracle that I came back. I didn't feel it was a miracle. I felt it was a curse at the time. Here is way harder than there. There is absolutely amazing. And one could even argue that this is about the worst hell you can ever have, is what you experience here. And that just goes to show you what's next is absolutely amazing. When I first came back, I went through all the tests. I woke up at 1:11 in the morning, and they wouldn't release me and allow me to leave until just after 7 a.m. So for It was about 7:15, 7:30 when I was leaving the hospital. They made me do all sorts of tests and sign all sorts of waivers, liability waivers, and all sorts of paperwork for me to be able to leave on my own. Yeah, it was hard. And I'll tell you, since I haven't had really any repercussions or residual effects of the actual event, other than I did, because I had a lot of seizures when they first brought the body back, it went into all sorts of weird seizures that, and I don't have seizures. That's not me. I've never had seizures. So it's just part of when you bring a body back, I guess sometimes that's what happens. And so I did have to eventually replace all my molars. Those seizures were pretty rough on the molars. They did what they call hyperfracturing. And so that over time, they just all started to fall apart on both sides of the mouth. So slowly over time, I had to replace all that. Other than that, no residual effects. My teenage daughter might say, no, I'm sometimes brain dead. But other than that, you know, I don't have any other residual effects. And, you know, I really enjoy and appreciate life in a whole new way because of my experience. And it's as sad as it is to say, I had to die so that I could learn how to live. I wasn't living the right way, even though I was raised evangelical Christian and raised in a way that I thought I was honoring essentially the plan of God and what God wanted for me. I wasn't, not in the way that I now know I'm supposed to. So it's very different for me now. I have to honor God in new ways, in caring for all people, all lives, no matter the form of that life, the color of that life, the religion of that life, the lifestyle of that life. I love them all. I love all creations of God in all their forms, all their colors, all their flamboyant ways of being. And it's beautiful to understand and embody who God is and how much the Creator has really reached out to this earth and put the presence of the Creator here in so many different forms so that we could connect to the Creator. And, you know, it doesn't matter the name we give to the Creator, it matters how we connect. And unfortunately, you know, our devices, they keep us from connecting to God. We connect to everything else, but not to God. And it's important for us to really reach out on a daily basis and have that sacred time with God daily in whatever form it works for you, you know?
That's beautiful. Don't feel bad. I think all teenagers think parents are brain dead. So you're not alone in that category.
She jokes about it sometimes.
You definitely went into this in a lot of depth and the beauty of your experience. You also mentioned how in some ways this is a worse hell than there. And what is the main thing? What is the, obviously your appreciation for earth and God and the creations and life itself, but what is the biggest lesson you came out of this learning that you needed to change your life and how you need to be more aware and what you could do to be just a better person?
Well, the number one thing is we're not here to be judged. We're not here to be judged. And there's a lot of people all over this world that beg to argue with me on that. But I'm telling you, I know we're not here to be judged. Life is not a courtroom. Life is a classroom. That's all it is, classroom. We're here so that we can learn to make choices, learn to create our reality. And we do create our reality. Whether we accept that or not doesn't change the fact that we create our reality. And how we create it is with our thoughts. So, you know, that's where we begin. Start really mastering your thoughts, you know, garnishing your thoughts, nurturing your thoughts, using your thoughts to put in the holiest of temples right here in between these two temples. That's the holiest place on earth. That's the most sacred space on earth. Allowing good things to be in there is so important. And don't just take yourself and open up any type of entertainment and allow in there just anything. Don't be very precise to what you allow and understand if you put garbage in, garbage out. If you put light in, light out. If you put love in, you get love out. It's a very reciprocated system. It's very simple, but yet we're all driving around these spiritual Lamborghinis and we pull up to the dump and we open our social, you know, we open up our social media or our streaming service, and we just start consuming garbage, nothing that's lifting you up, raising you up, or making you feel better about your life. And then we turn it off and we're like, how come I feel so bad about my life? I'm so uninspired. And it's like this is not a dilemma. Like, God sees this and says it's so blatant. We have to wake up and realize that we are what we allow in us. And yes, what we consume with our media is very important. And, you know, shows like you guys have here with The Mountain Life is inspirational and uplifting. And people need to be consuming things like this, good things. That's the things that people need to be seeking out in this life, and stop wasting your time on the short videos and the short, all the TikTok, YouTube shorts and all these things. Put it in good things, invest in your time and energy in good things. You'll get a good life. It's very simple, very basic.
It's beautiful. Have you spoken to Drake again?
Absolutely. Me and Drake are like best friends. We really are. I communicate with him daily. He's part of I call him my team. I've got a team of guides. I've got a couple of angels that I work with, and I work with him daily. For some people, they're going to be like, that guy's crazy. And you know, I would have been one of those people that judged, yeah, that guy's crazy. But you know what? I have to be authentic. I work with a spiritual team every single day. I do spirit coaching for people. I do life coaching for people. And if I didn't have that team, I wouldn't be sought after the way that I am, because I have that team. I connect to them. I really utilize them to help people connect to the core of creation, connect to who our creator is, and connect to the higher path for the individual. And, you know, we all have that ability, though. It's nothing special. I've always been an avid professor of the fact that all of us have this ability to connect to God and the cosmos and angels and guides and guardians and our ancestors that are all around us everywhere we go. Anytime we want to connect to them, we can. It's there. But if we're always connected here, it's hard to do, because this is the connection of the third dimension, and inside here is where we connect to the higher dimension. So we need to go to the sacred space on a regular basis and feel comfortable there. And that's where we connect to our team. Yeah.
We're speaking with Vincent Tolman about his journey to heaven and back. His book is called The Light After Death. And I just want to say for our listeners that when you've been talking about sort of the wrong kind of connection and you keep holding up your phone, we can see you. But just to tell our listeners, it's the phone. Oh, yeah. Wrong kind of connection. And it really does prevent us from connecting on much deeper levels in different ways. And Vincent, I'm wondering, you know, when you talk about your team of spirit guides, many of us have heard of people who are channels, right? They're channeling a guide. They didn't get there through going through a death experience like you did. And I'm just wondering, you know, what are we, those of us who don't believe that we have access to channeling spirit guides or whatever it is, or we think it's, you know, we're a little skeptical like we were, or we think it's maybe something for crazy people. What do you say about that? And how do we regard those people who call themselves channels, and how might we start tapping into that guidance for ourselves?
Well, you know, I love the example of Jesus Christ and how he exemplified the right way of being on earth. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of the show, The Chosen. I don't know if any of you watch that or not, but when you really dive into who Christ was and how he lived, that's how we need to identify ourselves is Christ went within. He dove within on a regular basis. And how we do that is through meditation. You don't need to go find some fancy program on meditation. Just go create a special place. Have your prayer, have your intention before you begin. and just sit quietly. You know, so many times we ask God for things in our life by, you know, praying or asking, and then we don't wait for an answer. Wait for the answer. The answer comes, and it comes very, sometimes very soon, sometimes as soon as we're asking the question. So, you know, give God space in your time, and God will show up. It's, you know, think about who Christ is and think of, take Christ out of the ancient past, put him in today's time. And how much time do you think Christ would spend on Facebook? How much time would Christ spend on TikTok or YouTube? I don't think much. So that's the ticket right there. And how much do you think Christ would watch the news? I don't think he ever would. I think that the news that Christ would be interested in would be the news from the Father, from the Creator. And that's where we need to be. We need to turn away from this world and be like the Christ, the anointed, and live the anointed life. That's where we change everything. Now, is it easy to just turn away from the past and or how we've lived? No, but you do it in little steps. Give yourself, you know, earmarks or guidelines and say, hey, I'm going to do less this. I'm going to do less that. I'm going to really dive into this meditation stuff and figure that out. There's tons of really good information all over online about that. And it, you don't even have to follow that. Just give yourself sacred space on a regular basis. Because if you give God time to show up, God shows up. You don't have to put fancy things around it. If you really connect to scriptures, go read scriptures and then give yourself a quiet 5-10 minutes after you read, just for what comes to you. And you'll be amazed at what comes to you if when you give yourself these quiet moments. And especially when you're surrounding these quiet moments with just intention. And intention is essentially our ability to create magic in our life. It's our magic wand, our intention is. So use that magic wand and really put intention to everything you do, and you'll watch things change. It's a beautiful thing.
Vincent, I want to go back to a question I meant to ask earlier, and it'll nag me ever if I don't ask it, and we're just about out of time. That supplement that you took, you know, so that was in 2002, 2003. Mm-hmm. And that was before fentanyl was sort of laced into lots of things you might buy on the street. It's currently one of the biggest issues of our time, leading cause of death among, you know, certain age groups. What was it that you took, and what shut you down?
So it was a product called Furanone Dehydro. It was a muscle. It was essentially like a muscle, I forget what the category they called it, but it would essentially help your recovery rate of your muscle happen 3 times faster than normal. So, you know, when you do, I used to be an amateur bodybuilder, and a buddy of mine did too. So together we were, you know, shooting for the ropes, trying to go for our other friend who was Mr. Olympia at the time. And a few of us were working out every day, a couple times a day. What this would do is you would rip or tear the muscle with your workout, and then the supplement, you'd take it and it would help the repair process, so you could work out that same group of muscles the very next day. And it was natural. It was not like an any type of steroid or anything like that, but it gave you a very quick bulking, so you could bulk up quite a bit. And then you'd actually get off of the supplement when you were trying to, you know, clean up the fat ratio and get clean on your body fat. But yeah, it was an amazing supplement at the time. And what we didn't know is the American stuff was very different than the same supplement outside the United States. So when you were buying it in the United States, you were getting a 5% diluted solution. So it was only 5% purity. The rest was just water added. And you would take a little bottle cap. And then the stuff you buy overseas from all the overseas suppliers, even though they didn't say this on their bottles, those were 100% solutions. And so us being the ignorant Americans, we took our same bottle cap, but because it was pure, it was not diluted, it was like taking 20 bottle caps of the American stuff. So that's where our mistake was, is we didn't realize that the stuff you were buying overseas was quite strong, 20 times stronger than what you buy in the United States. But you know, there, it was so popular. Everybody was using it at the time. You could not get it anywhere. In fact, all the waiting lists were just getting longer and longer, and none of it was showing up. because it was heading out the back door of all the vitamin shops for twice the price. You know, that's essentially what was happening to the entire market at the time because it was so popular. So, you know, that being said, we decided, hey, let's do the smart thing, go online. And we bought some from Thailand of all places. Yeah. And, and it came with Thailand instructions. We didn't, even though I lived in Thailand for a couple months, I didn't read Thai, so I couldn't read the instructions.
Well, a fascinating book. It's called The Light After Death, My Journey to Heaven and Back. Our guest is author Vincent Tolman. Vincent, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much for having me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. And you know, thank your audience. Love you guys. Love everybody. And thanks for this journey and path that you're all on.
Hi, it's Katie Mullally. Join us Thursday at 9 a.m. for Cool Science Radio. We speak with Mike Rucker about how the pursuit of joy and wonder can change your life. It's grounded in current research, accessible science, and practical recommendations. Then, we speak with Mark Abrahams about the Ig Nobel Awards, created to honor the science and research that makes us laugh and then think. Join us Thursday for Cool Science Radio at 9 a.m.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm David Windsor. Vincent Tolman, what an incredible story that is very hard to fathom that you can go through that type of an experience and come back and live to tell it. It was quite interesting to speak with them, and I'm glad that we had the opportunity to do so. It's a beautiful, freezing cold day here in Park City. Make sure you put your jackets on, make sure you stay warm, and make sure that you go out and get Vincent's book, Light After Death, as well as Pico's book, The Half-Known Life in Search of Paradise. You're listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County. 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app, or ask your smartphone speaker to play KPCW Radio.